Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch from the City of Champions. We talk every week about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, you may not have ever considered oral health, especially not World Oral Health Day. That's a hard one. But after hearing from our first guest, Marielle Parisot, you'll think about how important oral health is.
Good morning, Lynn. Then we'll speak with Scott Escott. That's it. He's the trail coordinator for Moab Trail Mix, the trails organization that has added hundreds of miles to Moab Trail networks in just the last few years.
And if there's time, you thought smoking was bad? Well, we'll talk a little bit about the new smoking. It's being desk bound. I've talked a little bit about this.
The 7-minute workout.
Mm-hmm. It's this week's version. It must be something about my complex of being desk bound these days. But, you know, a lot of us are. You a lot more than you used to be. So
that's true.
All right. This is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, Dave, when is the best time for a story?
Sunday mornings at 8:30.
Hi, this is Kathy.
And I'm Dave. We're co-hosts of The Story Mine. Tune in Sunday mornings right here at KPCW.
Experience the treasures of storytelling every Sunday morning at 8:30.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we make promises all the time. We just don't keep them.
Is any of the show going to air?
None. None.
I'm Peter Sagal. Tune in to hear things that none of us ever imagined saying on the radio. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Heard on KPCW Saturday morning at 9, thanks to 350 Main and the Spur Bar and Grill.
Hi, this is Eric Karshner, Assistant General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club and sponsor of The Mountain Life on KPCW. Park Meadows Country Club is Park City's in-town private country club, just minutes from historic Main Street. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, believe it or not, tomorrow, March 20th, is World Oral Health Day. Now, this may be something we don't think a lot about, but as it turns out, a lot more goes on in our mouths than we probably even know about. And joining us in the studio is Marielle Parisot. She's the founder and CEO of the group Shaping the Future of Dentistry. Marielle Parisot lives here in Park City and is actually a Canadian dentist, which will be part of our conversation as well. And Marielle, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn, and it's a pleasure for me to be here this morning.
Well, it's nice to have you and your beautiful smile. And of course, isn't that the first thing that people do when you say you're a dentist? They look at your smile.
They do that. A lot of reactions I get to is hiding their own smile, which is a shame.
That is a shame. Well, tell us, you were first a dentist in Canada, and I'm always interested in the differences in oral health and teeth in general between countries. I think America is known to be throughout the world, you know, the place where everyone has beautiful teeth. Is it the same for Canada? What are the differences?
It's pretty much the same in Canada. The two countries are leaders in health and oral health, wealthy countries with a lot of educated people. So health seems to be at the forefront of a lot of things. However, there are disparities, and there are a lot of populations that are vulnerable, mainly immigrants, people of low socioeconomic status, and these are the people who either don't have access to care because they live in remote areas, or people who, like here in Wasatch County and Summit County, who are close enough to have access but they simply cannot afford it. A lot of people don't know, even in Utah, that in Wasatch County and Summit County, we have the highest rate of low socioeconomic people and people who are uninsured. And therefore, these are all the people who cannot access care because they cannot afford it.
Mario, what about the history of dentistry and oral health? When did it become recognized that our mouths were so important to our overall general health and kind of the integration of what happens in our gums and our teeth to the rest of our wellness? And I'm assuming that that wasn't always the case. I mean, that's kind of an assumption on my part, but we probably had physicians who did everything, and then dentistry kind of broke out as a subgroup as that became recognized that it was a critical element.
This is a very good question, Tim, and thank you so much for asking. There is still a separation, unfortunately, between overall health and oral health, and the connection is a recent one. And that connection seems to be more connecting disease with disease. We talk a lot about periodontal disease and the connection with cardiovascular disease. What the movement is all about today and what World Oral Health Day is all about is a promotion to move from disease fixing to prevention and then to health promotion, and to invite all oral health professionals to see the possibility of oral health becoming the foundation to total health. And when you think about that, it makes a lot of sense because everything that nourishes the body goes through the mouth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, going back maybe even further, you know, hundreds, thousands of years ago, imagine, and occasionally you hear stories about what it was like for those people who had an abscess or an abscess in one of their teeth, what they would do in the absolute pain. It has to be one of the greatest pains there is after childbirth. That's my opinion.
Well, you hear that.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe even before childbirth.
Yes. And, you know, even today, in old times, in prehistoric times, a bad tooth infection led to death sometimes. And unfortunately, this is still happening in third world countries. And even here in the United States, not that long ago, there was the story that made the newspaper of this teenage boy who died as a result of a severe tooth infection. So, yes, if there is no access to care, a tooth decay can become life-threatening.
So in the case of this boy, and I did not read that article or hear about that, that's just horrific to
yes.
hear of. So he had an abscess or a tooth decay that mm-hmm. that created an abscess. And then what was the ultimate cause of death? And what was, it's not good enough to just pull the tooth, right?
Correct. There are certain areas where a tooth abscess can lead to an infection of the brain, or that is usually from upper molars. When it's a lower molar, it can lead to so much swelling in vital spaces of breathing and swallowing that it can also cause death. And these things happen. You'd be surprised to know that children, I know the statistics for Canada, I can only imagine that these statistics are similar here in the United States, but in Canada, in Ottawa, the nation's capital, I think the statistics go back to 2010. They were 3 kids hospitalized every month because of a severe tooth infection that potentially was life-threatening. And these are statistics that don't make the headlines. Mm-hmm. And this is happening in a city where people are well-educated, people do have access to care, and these things are still happening. People don't know that tooth decay is still the number one disease in the world. It's affecting 90% of the world population, and it is preventable.
I did hear a staggering statistic recently, and I believe it was in Summit County, about That's the number one cause of children missing school.
Yes.
Is a toothache.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And it's also the number one cause of parents missing work because of a child's toothache.
Mm-hmm.
And what people don't realize is that a child who ends up either in emergency or an emergency appointment at the dental office or in the hospital, this is a child that's been suffering for a long time.
Yeah.
And imagine being a young child who you cannot sleep well at night. Mm. How can you learn in school? And if you have so much pain in your mouth, how can you eat well? And if it happens to affect your front teeth, how can you smile? And if you smile, do you look competent? So it leads people surrounding that child making assumptions about this child's intelligence, this child's competence to learn, to become a productive adult in life. And it's something that could be totally preventable.
You said preventable a number of times. So let's yes. talk about what the preventable measures are that people can do or that we are doing that are addressing this issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for asking. I really wanted to get there. We have been promoting brushing and flossing for a long, long time in dental offices. And perhaps dentists were promoting or moving towards prevention as pioneers in that direction, even before physicians. What also affects oral health is what goes through our mouth. So this is where the connection of oral health to overall health comes in. And what we often don't think of is the food that we put in our mouth is affecting the balance in our mouth. If we consume too many carbohydrates, sugars, simple sugars like sucrose, lactose, fructose, and all fermentable carbohydrates, believe it or not, that includes potato chips, which we never think as being a cause of cavities. So the consumption of these foods and the frequency of consumption changes the balance in the mouth of the natural bacteria that live there in favor of cavity-causing bacteria.
And so that's not even an issue of food sitting in the crevices between your teeth. This is a completely different issue. This is an imbalance in the bacteria, the natural balance is being affected, and we have an imbalance of the bacteria in the mouth, and therefore it's not able to create the immune or promote the health that it would normally be able to
yes.
promote.
Yes, exactly. And the main characteristic of cavity-causing bacteria, mainly these are strep mutans and lactobacilli. These are the two main bacteria. They are acid-producing and acid-loving, which means that they love to live in an acidic milieu, and when they digest all the carbohydrates in your diet, the byproduct of that digestion causes more acid, and it is the acid that they produce that causes a demineralization of the teeth that eventually leads to tooth decay. So that's where the imbalance is. And therefore, the more carbs you eat, and especially if you eat carbs frequently, you have more and more and more and more of these bacteria. So you're starting a vicious cycle.
So that's interesting. Are they finding then that the flora, the health of your gut is more important for tooth and oral health than actually what's in your mouth in terms of, you know, the food that, you know, if you don't floss or brush often enough, is it more important what's coming from your gut?
I think there is a connection there, but it is indirect. The flora of the mouth is a separate entity. And I think what we see, and we saw a very good presentation by Dr. Smar at the Eccles Center just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
He was talking a lot about the gut bacteria. And I found his presentation very interesting because there is a reflection there, too. He was talking a lot about the consumption of carbs and the change in the gut flora. And I think in a lot of instances, we may never be able to establish a direct correlation between the flora of the mouth and the flora of the gut, but certainly they mirror one another. And I think as a dentist, if I start seeing cavities in the mouth of a patient, It's a reflection of an imbalance in the mouth that could be mirrored elsewhere in the body with gut problems or with kidney problems or even with fatal cardiovascular disease, mm-hmm. even in the absence of obesity. So this is where the interesting connections start to happen.
Well, and to follow up on Lynn's thought about the flora of the mouth, it's if you missed if you miss a couple of flosses or toothbrushing, mm-hmm. which I know we're not supposed to do, but your flora in your mouth is really healthy, are you going to be okay? I mean, which in the hierarchy of what to do, there's sort of that preventative, proactive brushing and flossing, but also very proactive and addressing the same issue is the flora of the mouth.
Yes. Wow. This is a loaded question. Where can I begin to answer this one?
Well, I'm just thinking if you're not eating a lot of carbohydrates and you're not eating a lot of sugar and, you know, for some reason, let's say you have to miss brushing your teeth. Can you go to bed and sleep comfortably with that?
You should have nightmares all night.
Tim often forgets his
the tooth fairy.
Brush
you should see
traveling.
My tooth fairy.
She lives
not a pleasant person, that tooth fairy.
I know. She lives in my house, too. What happens, maybe if you have experienced that yourself, Tim, when you miss a couple of flossings or even once, and I've done that myself, you will notice that there are some areas in your mouth where it bleeds. Your gums bleed as you floss. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I have noticed that.
Yeah. And that is a problem because the bleeding of the gums is an indication that the bacteria living in your mouth have actually started breaking down your tissues. If we were able to look at your gums under the microscope when they bleed, there are microscopic ulcers in your gum. And when you floss, that gives access to some of the bacteria that live in your mouth to enter your bloodstream. And researchers have found that in the blood vessels of people afflicted with cardiovascular disease, they have found the same bacteria as the bacteria that live in your mouth.
Lynn might not let me talk about this because this is a beautiful segue into my GGS, Glowing Green Smoothie, which I've been doing almost for a year now consecutively every morning for breakfast. And I just want to say that I think it has changed the bacterial makeup of my mouth. A couple of things that I'll say that ties into what you just said. When I miss flossing and then floss, my gums no longer bleed. And they used to, going back a year or 2 years ago, just like you've said, a lot. There was a fair amount of blood. Now, I also used to eat a lot of potato chips a year ago, and I don't eat potato chips anymore, which I also tie into the Green Glowing Smoothie. It's kind of changed my food preference. But I'll tell you what, I think I can feel a different flora in my mouth from this smoothie. It has definitely changed things and it feels healthier.
How about your breath? Do you have less bad breath?
Yeah, I think so.
Hmm.
Of course, I didn't.
Maybe you should ask other people if your breath is.
You need to check if you could do a survey.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for mentioning this because I have a project that hopefully I'll be able to run starting late this summer. I would like to prove that if people change their diets and start eating healthier foods, we can actually observe a change in the flora of the mouth, reverse it. I mean, if one way is possible, if people eat too many carbs, it leads to a change in the population of the bacteria of the mouth. I believe that the reverse is possible, and I think you're the walking example of this, Tim. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
He always works in the Green Glowing Smoothie into our interview, no matter if we're, you know, we could be talking about rocket science. And
well, we're going to talk about trails, and I'll get it in there.
That's right. Okay. So I'm curious about a couple of things. One of those is fluoride, and I know there have been different movements throughout the time that says, you know, fluoride is toxic, which it is in large amounts. But what are the evolving beliefs about fluoride and taking it either in with toothpaste or orally in a pill? What's your take on that?
Fluoride is so important. And I know there are polarized positions around fluoride. Fluoride is an ion, and it's negatively charged. And when you include it in either water or toothpaste or a mouthwash, it adsorbs to a tooth. So it doesn't just coat the enamel. It kind of penetrates partway into it. And because it is negatively charged, it attracts calcium and phosphate to it, which helps remineralize the teeth. And calcium and phosphate are naturally present in healthy saliva. So when you add fluoride to the mix, you really speed up the remineralizing process. And maybe I should talk a little bit more about that, because in the mouth, there is a constant cycle of demineralization and remineralization. When we eat food, a lot of the food and beverages that go through our mouth are acidic. And because of certain bacteria in the mouth, when we have carbs in our diet, they produce acid. Mm-hmm. So saliva plays an important role in remineralizing the teeth between food attacks.
Mm-hmm.
When you add fluoride to the mix, it speeds up the process, and not only that, the resulting enamel becomes stronger as a result. So enamel definitely has a place even in holistic dentistry. So I'm definitely pro-fluoride, and it's very important for adults and children, including very young children, to use a toothpaste that contains fluoride. It makes a huge difference.
Okay, so for those people who just are vehemently opposed to taking fluoride, if they have a very alkaline diet, or, you know, the opposite of acidic, then their teeth will be better off. Because there are those people out there who are not going to take fluoride, no mm-hmm. matter what mm-hmm. is told.
If we can manage to balance a diet that doesn't include too many carbs, and the natural bacteria in the mouth are a healthy mix, fluoride is not necessary. However, when you start thinking of very young children, think of your two-year-old with whom you have to fight to brush teeth every night before going to bed, or even your 6 or 7-year-old who's grown independent and doesn't want help from an adult anymore.
Your 19-year-old.
So there are times where things are just not really well balanced. Mm-hmm. Too much snacking, the wrong kinds of snacks. So, you know, fluoride has a place.
Okay. Why are people so against fluoride? What's the negative side of fluoride? Lynn just said it's toxic. And I mean, I know it's not part of the holistic makeup, but what is the downside of fluoride?
Well, let me first say that fluoride is a natural occurring element. And what led to the fluoridation of water in many cities is many observations that go back in the 50s of places where water was naturally fluoridated, and those populations had very little tooth decay. Now, the groups who are anti-fluoride often come up with terrible examples of kids who have been poisoned by fluoride, but these were overdoses. So we cannot talk about overdoses and compare that with water fluoridation, where the water fluoridation is totally optimal. These are two different things. You know, we still sell aspirin in drugstores and Advil and Tylenol, and these are all medications that when you overdose on it, you can kill yourself. So extreme situation, polarized positions that we need to find a happy medium with those
right.
positions.
Okay, moving into something deeper and darker. there are those folks who have a root canal done, and it unleashes some sort of latent infection. And, well, I know about this because it happened to me, but since then I've heard about all of these very deep infections. Do they end up, Tim and I were talking about this before the show, do they end up being a systemic infection? And how does it tie in to when you, if you go to get knee surgery, they ask you about your oral health?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. To answer your first question, the body has a natural ability to deal with infection. It's your immune system, and oftentimes a localized infection, an infection that is attached to a tooth, will be naturally encapsulated by your body. Your body will contain it to the very small area that surrounds the tooth. You will suffer greatly if you have that, because the bone, especially the lower jaw, doesn't tolerate pressure very well. So it creates a lot of pain, but basically the infection is contained in that area. Now, when it comes to needing a joint replacement or having open heart surgery, it is very important that the mouth is in very good health, because some of the bacteria in the mouth have affinity for joints and or heart valves. And that's where the problem is. And this is why it's so important to have good oral health.
Very
interesting. To make sure that everything else goes well.
Tomorrow is World Oral Health Day. Our guest is Marielle Parisot. She's the founder and CEO of Shaping the Future of Dentistry. And is there any one last nugget of wisdom that we need to know, Marielle?
Consider your oral health as the foundation for overall health, and that everything that goes through your mouth not only contributes to your health, but also to your oral health.
Very good. All right, Marielle, thank you so much for coming in today. And we'll be back in just a moment with Scott Escott. We actually spoke with him early this morning because he was headed out in Moab to work on the trails with a group of volunteers. So we taped that conversation earlier this morning. Stay with us. This is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch.
Winter is in full swing at the Utah Olympic Park. The park is open daily from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Explore the Alf Ingen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Olympic Winter Games Museum. Take a guided Olympic heritage tour or watch athletes train while enjoying a hot beverage from the Silver Bean Cafe. Info and rates are available online at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Parking and admission is free. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, we at KPCW and The Mountain Life are proud to be co-sponsors of the appearance next Tuesday of Dr. Mark Hyman, who will provide a free wellness presentation at the Jim Santee Auditorium. Dr. Hyman is famous as the author of The Blood Sugar Solution and other New York Times bestsellers on wellness, dieting, and nutrition. The program begins next Tuesday evening at 6:30 with the screening of the Sundance documentary from this year's festival, Fed Up, which features Dr. Hyman. It's followed by a presentation and Q&A with him. You may also have seen Dr. Hyman on specials, which run on PBS television stations nationwide. Dr. Hyman's appearance here is co-sponsored by Jewish Family Services, the Christian Center of Park City, the People's Health Clinic, and KPCW. Again, it's next Tuesday evening at 6:30 at the Jim Santee Auditorium. We'll also be speaking with him here on the local news hour with Leslie Thatcher on Monday. I believe it's at 8:40 a.m. Well, you've heard of the Mag 7 trails, Klondike Bluff trails, Klonzo, maybe the Brand trails
in
Moab.
Or if you haven't, you should have.
That's right. That's right. It is a stellar system of trails. We were wondering how they do it, how it's funded. It's a group called Moab Trail Mix, and the mix is a mix of all the entities, whether Forest Service, BLM, private interests, that come together to create trails in Moab, that place that we love to go about this time of year. So we spoke this morning with Scott Escott. He's the trails coordinator for the group, and he told us a little about it. We needed to talk to him early because he was busy out creating more trails. And so we'll air that interview. Good morning to you, Scott Escott.
Thank you very much. Good to be on your show.
So, Scott, you are trails coordinator for the place that has the trails that many of us here in Park City love more than, you know, just about any other place other than Park City, of course, Moab, Utah. And first of all, why don't you run through who the players are that make up Trails Mix, and how does that portion of it all work?
Okay, Trail Mix is a Grand County advisory board, and it's made up mainly of volunteers. And we work in partnership with the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park, the Forest Service, the county, the city, Utah State Parks, and there are many different partners. Moab Trails Alliance is also one of our sister partners, and we all get together once a month, have a meeting, discuss our projects, where we need to head, and it's a very efficient organization.
So, in essence, then, Trail Mix is the entity that gathers everyone else together, gathers the funding, and then goes and builds the trails?
Exactly, and we're the steering group. If you came to Trail Mix and said, oh, I have a proposal for this trail, we would, first of all, see if it's feasible, and second of all, steer you through the process. And, you know, land ownership, funding, archaeology, you know, all the requirements that we have to run through to work on federal land.
Scott, how did Trail Mix, I'm curious about the history and the evolution, because here at Park City, you know, we've had kind of a recent trail development over the last 20 years where it's really gained traction and momentum and really come into its own. And we sort of have this view of Moab as always having been this amazing trail mecca, but I'm sure that's not the case. I mean, I think my recollection is that the Slick Rock Trail was originally a dirt bike trail, a motorized trail, not a non-motorized trail. So how did it come into being, and what was the time frame that this took place?
Well, you know, it probably has occurred about 20 years ago, but a group of Moab residents got together, mainly Kim Shepard, who is on the board of Moab Trails Alliance and also board of directors for Trail Mix, and David Olson, who's a city planner, and they got together and realized that we needed a non-motorized trail organization. And so they formed Trail Mix, I think it was in, 1998. So it's actually a pretty new process as far as building new trails. In 2008, the Bureau of Land Management finished their resource management plan. And in that resource management plan, there was 150 miles of non-motorized single track that was to be built. And Trail Mix took that on.
And something that strikes me as really an element of all this trail use that you guys do incredibly well, and it's sort of forced upon you. Again, it's this motorized and non-motorized, but I'm just fascinated by how you have been able to create what seems to be a very good working relationship between the motorized users and the non-motorized users. Is that something that was difficult to a partnership or a cooperative arrangement that was difficult to put together, or has it been a fairly simple thing because of the origins kind of coming from the motorized side?
No, it actually has been fairly simple because the resource management plan set aside mountain bike focus areas to build the 150 miles of single track. And these are, most of them are, non-motorized areas. The Moab Brands has one road that goes through it. Klondike pretty much has two roads that go through it. Klonzo has no roads that go through it. Mag 7's got the Gemini Bridge Road. So it was actually pretty easy. And, the motorized community really was not involved in our direction of where we want to build the trails and so forth. It really all had to do with BLM having the foresight to realize that the user groups needed to be separated just because of overpopulation, how many people come here, and that we needed more non-motorized trails. I mean, if you look at Park City has built, how many miles of single track, while we pretty much hadn't built any until about 4 years ago.
Yeah. And, you know, what we're seeing is that it seems every subsequent trip to Moab, every visit, there's another new network. It's so phenomenal to me, the speed at which you have built not just trails here and there, but entire networks. And I'm curious about that, going to the Mag 7 trails, for example, or all the trails built around Klondike, the Klondike Bluff area. How did it evolve into saying, well, we want to do a network here?
Well, you know, I've been a mountain bike guide, and I've ridden all over the West, and it's very obvious that the users, what you want to do is you want to drive to a trailhead and have numerous choices. You want to be able to go for a 1 hour or 4 hour ride. So closed loop systems are really the way to go for a single track. And, so, you know, we have these big focus areas. I mean, all of Klondike is a mountain bike focus area. So we're able to go in there with, you know, the designers, you know, whoever, you know, proposes a trail and go in and say, okay, look, we can put in, Klondike has 50 miles of new single track. Mm. And, you know, create something that you can go there, you know, one time or 10 times and it won't get old. So.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And, you know, it strikes me that now that you have all these trails networks built and a lot of, you know, beginner and intermediate trails, it strikes me how it was way back when you'd go to Moab and you'd ride really difficult trails. I mean, the Slick Rock Trail is not for everyone. Porcupine Right. Rim, Poison Spider. So obviously you had this, you know, the knowledge that you needed to appeal to a variety of trail users, families. Wow. I mean, the brand trails, you can take your four-year-old out on that.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, every system, we've made a internal agreement at Trail Mix that, you know, every system we do, right out of the parking lot, there should be a kid's trail. And, you know, some of the stuff coming down the pike in the next 2 years is going to even go a little bit further on that because, you know, that's the future of mountain biking. You know, this is a huge part of our economy. It's the second, you know, hiking and view shed is the largest part of our economy. Huh. People come to the parks naturally. And the second part of the economy is mountain biking. So, you know, we're looking at the four-year-olds, you know, coming back when they're 5, 6, 20 years old. So it's very important for this community.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Scott Escott. He's the trails coordinator for the group Moab Trail Mix.
Scott, in the bigger picture of people using trails, I'm hearing you say a couple of things. When you pull into the trailhead and get out of your car, trail networks, these nodes that have been created that are kind of separate little development areas, is there any thought about connecting or having a central location where people can just get on a bicycle and ride to these networks, or is that not really the focus at this point?
Well, you know, unlike Park City, where, you know, everything's relatively close, right. I mean, to ride a bike from town to North Klondike is a pretty large endeavor.
Yeah.
We have, through Moab Trails Alliance has made the transit hub right there when you come across the bridge across the Colorado. And I think the ultimate goal of the BLM, the land managers and so forth, is that that becomes a transit hub where people could get on a shuttle vehicle and go to North Klondike and then ride back. There's already existing roads everywhere where you can get from, you know, Klondike to Klonzo to the Brands back to town. So it's all there. I think it's just a matter of, you know, figuring out how to set up shuttle systems.
And how about the paved trails? I've noticed those also. You can't help but notice them. I mean, there's that fabulous paved trail that parallels the road as you're coming from the Klondike into Moab on the left-hand side. And it even cuts under the highway at some point and goes, you know, it goes back and forth. It's really quite amazing. I haven't been on that, but I would imagine that's hugely popular for people that aren't, you know, at the level of getting out on the slick rock and out onto some of the tougher trails just to be on a bicycle or even running or hiking or anything.
Right. It's a wonderful access for people, and you're right. I mean, it picks up a lot of the business that wouldn't necessarily go ride the brands. The beautiful thing about it is you can ride from town. You can go to the brands. You can go to 7-Up Trail. You'll be able to go, you know, ride all the way up through 13, hop into the Mag 7 system. So it's a great access. And thank you to Moab Trails Alliance, because they were the ones that really made that happen, Kim Shepard especially.
And then are they the same folks that would be responsible for the paved trail that parallels the trail going up the Colorado in the other direction, which, I mean, the amount of infrastructure that went into that is just, it's staggering. I mean, that's on its own support system that hangs out over the river. I mean, it's really amazing. I wrote it just, you know, a week ago, and it wasn't there the last time I came down, and here it is, and it's literally suspended out over the river. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah, it's once again, you know, that's a huge project. Huge project. I don't know how many millions of dollars that was, federally funded. You know, and excellent, because the big thing there was to get the traffic off of the road coming off of Porcupine. And, you know, Porcupine, the whole enchilada, is probably, you know, one of the most famous trails in the world, and heavily used. It's probably one of our most heavily used trail systems. So,
Well, I want to kind of take a trail in isolation to ask you a little bit more about just how you do it. And I think the most recent newest trail is one I was lucky enough to ride a couple weeks ago, the Haimasa trail, which sort of parallels or gives you an option so you don't go on the Amasa back Jeep trail. And then it makes a big loop and you hook up with Captain Ahab for a great downhill. And oh, I love that trail. I want to ask a couple questions about, I mean, you're on this trail and you go, how do they build these trails? There are boulders the size of cars. How do they move them? What tools do you have in your bag?
Well, you know, I cut my teeth on the Pipe Dream Trail, which is very similar to Captain Ahab. And actually, it was probably considerably harder than Captain Ahab to build. And one of the things that we realized right away is that if we didn't have the capability to move large rocks and place large rocks, we could never build a trail. We could never make a trail sustainable. We could never actually make a trail flow. And, you know, trails would be very herky-jerky if you didn't have that capability. So there is a device, non-fossil fuel device, and it's called a grip hoist. And in simple terms, what it is a high-tech come-along that has a forward and reverse. You can backpack it in. It's got 75 feet of cable, and you find an anchor that's bigger than what you want to move, and you can place a rock wherever you want. And grip hoists run from 1-ton to 8-ton capability, so it's actually extremely simple. It's very safe, and Ahab, Pipe Dream, a lot of the stuff out in North Klondike, the new Alaska Trail, you know, they required moving boulders considerably bigger than Subarus and considerably heavier than Subarus and placing them. So that's our main tool. And, you know, all the 90 miles that we've built, I mean, that's all been not machine built. I mean, we've all built all this miles by hand.
Wait, so this thing is operated by hand? I mean, there's no power to it. It's not battery operated. How could it be? It's just by hand. It's like some sort of lever system that you kind of have to see to be able to believe.
Yeah, I'd be terrified to actually take one apart, look at it. You know, springs and gears and everything would probably pop out, but It really is extremely simple to use. It's just got a 4-foot lever with a forward and reverse on it, and the cable runs through it. It's amazing. It's heavy. You hate when you have to use it because it takes, you know, three people to backpack it into your job site. So,
wow.
You know, but you guys should come down and, you know, bring your organization down for a day of seeing it in action, because it's amazing what it can do. Very simple.
I'd like to do that.
Yeah.
We look for any excuse to go to Moab.
Yeah, we have to go see the grip hoist. We better go to Moab.
Yeah.
So, well, that brings me into the question about funding and volunteers. I know at least the Oakley School here in Oakley, just outside of Park City, has for years, big groups of people. And you mentioned this the other day when we spoke. Tons of groups come down to help. How do you pull that off?
You know, a lot of those come through the Bureau of Land Management. The Bureau of Land Management will send their volunteers to Trail Mix, and I'm actually the volunteer organizer for Trail Mix. So, matter of fact, today, as soon as I'm done with the interview, I'm going out with Western State out of Gunnison, and we're going to do a trail day. And so we get, you know, this break is a big time. We get colleges, we get church groups, Boy Scouts, on and on and on and on. And, you know, without volunteers, this just wouldn't be happening. We are a very poor organization compared to most trail groups. For example, Trails 2000 in Durango has around a $400,000 yearly budget, and we run on about a $40,000 a year budget, mainly through the use of volunteers. We have a core group of volunteers, the oldsters, because they're all really old, and they work Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you know, 3 days of work, 3 days a week, building trail, and some of them also work Tuesday and Thursday doing the politics of it. So volunteers are a large part of our funding. Without them, I think last year we ran somewhere around $100,000 in volunteer hours. How do you like that?
Yeah,
cheap organization.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow.
So, Scott, as far as kind of the economic drivers of this whole thing, I mean, obviously the town and community of Moab realizes the economic importance that non-motorized and motorized trail use brings to the community. But it sounds like the BLM is sort of the primary driver. They don't have an economic incentive, but the community does. So have you kind of taken on some of these projects on behalf of the BLM because you're seeing some of the non-motorized use go to places like Fruita, places like Park City that 20 years ago didn't exist or weren't on the radar? It was just Moab. And now there are other places to go if you're looking for a mountain bike vacation.
Without a doubt. You know, Moab was definitely losing its market share. And, you know, I've lived here for 25 years, and 5 years ago, before I took this job, I was going to leave because the writing was old, stale, so forth and so on. And we could see a dwindling market share because people would come here and go, "Oh yeah, I've ridden the Slick Rock, I've ridden Porcupine. There's nothing new." And so, you know, it's something that had to happen. From a selfish standpoint, it was something I wanted to make happen so I could continue to live here. And, it is a driver. Fortunately for us, the BLM is, you know, they're such a partner. They don't propose trails. They basically work in conjunction with us, and they give us the support that we need so that we can make this happen. You know, archaeology, for example, if Trail Mix had to pay for an archaeologist, we probably have maybe 5 miles of new trails. But the BLM provides that because it's on federal land. And, you know, I can't say enough about these guys. They live here. They care about the community. And, you know, in my world of being a mountain biker and building trails, they're doing a great job for us. I'm sure there's criticism in other areas, but, you know, there always is. So
Scott, we're almost out of time, but just real quickly, give us a little peek at what the next big project is or next area of development.
Well, right now we have a Utah State grant for 40 miles. Klonzo is going to be doubled. That's what we were doing yesterday, the archaeology work on it. There'll be a new trail off of Highway 313. Will be part of the MAG 7 system, and that will be called Navajo Rocks. Then there's, when you get up to the top of Bull Run, another part of the MAG 7 system will be this completely new area called Area 313, which is stunning, to say the least. It'll be about 12 miles from new single track. And, you know, then there's a bunch of fill-in projects that we're doing. We're going to try and finish up on North Klondike. We have, I think, four more small loops that are going to go out there and tie a few things in the original baby steps. And, you know, very exciting. So probably, you know, we build about anywhere between, you know, 22 and 27 miles a year. So you can expect somewhere between 40 and 50 miles of new trails in the next 2 years.
That's incredible. And you can count on funding. It's federal funding. Where does the money come from if you're operating on $40,000 a year?
Yeah.
We know it costs a lot more than that to build a mile of trail.
Well, yeah, it does, you know, because they're a volunteer system. Our trails are very inexpensive, but
yeah.
The county gives us $10,000. Mud Trails Alliance runs a map system where they sell maps to shop. They give us about $17,500. Poison Spider, Chili Pepper, they all donate a fair amount of money. Private individuals, I mean, fundraising is a, you know, a major ongoing effort. I was told this when I took the job years ago, that you'd be spending a lot of time trying to figure out where the money comes from. So, but it's a good thing because, you know, one of the issues, I think, is that there are a lot of trails being built now that are extremely expensive. They're way overpriced. And, you know, it's gone kind of into this free market thing. And, you know, there are trails that are absurd, the cost of them. So I think all the communities have to be careful about who they get in bed with. You know, we've seen this in Fruto, we've seen it in Sedona, we've seen it, you know, lots of different communities. If you don't use your resources within your town, these trails are going to cost way too much money.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting point. Well, Scott Escott is the trails coordinator for Moab Trail Mix, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you today, Scott. And you're off today to, where did you say you were going?
We're going to Navajo Rocks with Western State out of Gunnison to build some trail.
All right. Well, have a wonderful day. Hope it's beautiful down there. I assume it is. It's clear and beautiful up here. All right.
And I'll come up and ride Flying Dog pretty soon.
All right. That sounds great. Thanks so much for your time, Scott.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that again was Scott Escott with Moab Trail Mix. Pretty amazing. I like that. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
We want to thank you for listening to The Mountain Life and thank our underwriters.
Park City Clinic, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Prudential Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, and Park Meadows Country Club.
And time now for NPR News. You're listening to KPCW Park City.